this is the design to teach people the skill set of making 10% every year, whether the markets are up or down.
All of the gold that had ever been mined throughout time, you could put it all together and put it in an Olympic-sized swimming pool.
If you had $1, it bought 20 times as much gold 50 years ago as it does today.
Meta are going to spend $70 billion this year on AI-related expenditure. And Microsoft, $120 billion.
This sounds all a little bit dangerous to me. Copper down 20% in a day, oil going negative.
China today still buys more than 50%, more than half of all the commodities in the world.
Definitely a yellow card for that one.
Almost a red card, actually.
Your capital is at risk. The value of your shares, ETFs and ETCs can fall as well as rise, which could mean getting back less than you originally put in. This content is for information purposes only and is not investment advice. Past performance is not an indication of future results. Welcome to episode 4 of The Art of Investing, entitled All That Glitters. This is brought to you by IG, the global investing platform. And as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts. No, it's not a Werther's original advert. It's Chris, CJ Fellingham and Mark Spice Holden. How are you, gents?
Hi, Rich.
Very well indeed. Thank you, Rich. Looking forward to this one.
Now, why have we entitled this episode All That Glitters, Chris?
We're going to be talking about various forms of gold in the loosest possible way. We've got black gold, oil, green gold, copper, gold, but also the new phase for digital gold, which is Bitcoin.
Excellent. Right, I'm getting the picture. So it's the commodity special. And what we're looking at, of course, week one, we looked into equities. Week two, we had our teaching from Commander Bond across here. And now we're doing the last of our deep dives into the asset classes. And that's ahead of next week, the big launch on the portfolio. So today, as you might have noticed by now, we go into markets every week and go through what's been the big stories of the week. And the reason for that is, of course, we're launching our own live portfolio next week using all the asset classes that we've spoken about in the last few weeks. Then today, we're going to go through our commodity special. And then finally, ahead of the big launch next week, we are going to introduce some of the names of the ETFs, of the instruments that we're going to use in that portfolio. So what has been happening in the markets this week? CJ, this could be a whole episode in itself.
Well, it's been an absolutely huge week for data and for company reporting. There's been an avalanche of company reports from all around the world. And we'll just touch on a few of them because there are way too many. For example, there's 25% of the S&P 500 are reporting this week. That's just, you know, that's 120, 225 companies, which is just amazing. And that's happening everywhere around the world. The great news is that actually, on the whole, those results have been pretty good. So you've seen NASDAQ and the S&P 500, the two biggest stock markets in the world, hit new time highs again. And I repeat myself from last week, you know, here we go again. They pushed up. Now, to give you some context, NASDAQ is now up 45% from its April the 7th low.
Wow.
And the S&P 500 is up 34%. Now, these are massive markets. So the S&P 500 is capitalized at $56 trillion. So it's absolutely enormous. And even the FTSE 100, once again, here we go. Right. Cheer. FTSE 100 hitting the all-time high.
You.
There we go.
They said it would never happen.
2 weeks in a row. Gosh, can it make three? Let's see. Anyway, all the other markets have done pretty well. They're also consolidating towards their all-time highs. But probably the biggest shock we got, and we'll go into this in a bit more detail when we talk about commodities, was the copper price had its biggest ever fall, single-day fall. It fell over 20%, as we're reporting now. Last night, it fell 20% in a straight line. And that's because Donald Trump came along and basically changed the tariff regime for copper, He basically said, look, you can bring basically raw copper, unrefined copper, if you like, into the US without a tariff because we want to manufacture it into things like copper pipes, et cetera, in the US. And that's what he's trying to do with all this tariff, is trying to bring manufacturing into the US. But if you have manufactured outside, then you're going to stick to a 50% tariff.
Just call that one back just to show how Donald says one thing and then thinks on his feet, or maybe doesn't think on his feet. Somebody else does a little bit of work in the background and says, Donald, that wasn't the most sensible thing you ever said. And then he changes, because he started off saying anything to do with copper had this tariff on it. Then he realised that it takes 25 years to mine any copper. You want to build a new copper mine, sink all the investment in there, do all the stuff, takes 25 years. We can't do that in the short term. Oh, so let's change the rules.
Absolutely. He's obviously had a lot of American executives whinging at him that, you know, it was going to hurt them. And quite rightly so. I mean, copper goes into so many things, house building, wires, AI stuff. It's
and
everywhere.
The new data centers and the electric cars. And
yeah. I mean, it's one of the biggest commodities out there and a very valuable one, obviously. So, yes, he sort of, threw the cat amongst the pigeons last night. When we spoke last week, we were waiting to see if he was going to give the European Union a favourable tariff deal. And we were guessing that it would be the same as he gave Japan earlier in the week. And he did. He duly delivered with that a 15% sort of tariff for Europe. So that was good. European markets reacted accordingly and just rose a little bit on the back of that.
Did that go down with individual countries in Europe?
Well, I'm not going to get into European politics, trust me. That's for another podcast, maybe at Christmas. And my kids will never forgive me. The more shocking one was that actually India, obviously you now have the biggest population in the world, were hit with a 25% tariff. And they were hoping for a 19% tariff. But just to show you that this is all getting behind us now, the Indian stock market basically fell about 1% when it was immediately announced and ended the next sort of 24 hours actually higher than that.
Okay.
So it shows you that sometimes there's a saying in the markets, it's better to travel and arrive. And, in this case, people had expected it probably to be a bit worse than anticipated. And it was. So the market said, okay, fair enough. And on we go. Let's look forward to the
next.
And
at last, can we put tariffs behind us? We put them to bed and that's it.
Personally, I think probably have. I think any news now we get on tariffs, apart from the ones that surround Russia, because there is... And this is going to talk about in, some of the commodities particularly, but countries who are buying resources like oil from Russia, like India are doing, by the way, then in China, they might get additional tariffs put on them because they are trading with Russia. And basically Trump wants to bring that war with Ukraine to an end. And he sees the tariff threat on those other countries as a way of putting pressure on Putin and co. to end that war. And that, if he does that, then that's great because we don't like war.
Can I say a couple of things there? One, on the tariffs, I don't think we can put them to bed because I think that Trump has shown how easily he can bully the rest of the world. And so any other issues that come along, he'll just say at some stage, well, if you don't cooperate, we'll put some more tariffs on you. The other thing I want to say is Mark said something very important there with regard to a city saying, better to travel than to arrive.
Mm-hmm.
It's a saying that's been around for years and years and years. And essentially what it means is that the market's job is to anticipate things before they happen. And this goes back to one of our first episodes where we talked about the fact that people get surprised that when some results come out, the market goes down rather than up because they were great results. And it's all due to what has been anticipated and what then that happens. So an old city saying, better to travel than to arrive means we've now got to the stage where the news is there and it's all been discounted already.
And it's been discounted. So unless something happens that completely unpredictable, like the Black Swan event, then generally the process is it's being priced in as we move along. So when you arrive and the actual headline comes out,
it's not new news.
So there's been an avalanche of results from around the world. I think I'm going to pick just a few out here, but Europe's biggest company until a month or two back was Novo Nordisk. Now, those of you who want to lose some weight, they do this great weight loss tablet, or what they're trying to introduce as a tablet. It's an injection at the moment.
A subject close to your heart or your stomach.
Some say I've lost weight. Some would say I haven't. But there we go. Anyway, either way, they basically had a massive profits warning. Now, we were talking about expectation management last time. And if you remember, it's better to sort of get numbers low, then you beat them, and then your share price should go up. Well, Novo Nordisk cut their revenue forecast for their two biggest drugs by 30%, 30%. The shares fell 25% as a result. They're very poor expectation management. And they, you know, the last time they reported was only 6 months ago.
Yeah.
So clearly they've disappointed people. It was Europe's biggest company. It's no longer. It's now the second biggest company behind basically German software company SAP is now number one. And ASML, who we talked about last week, is basically the third biggest one. But really the big results of the week, which we highlighted were coming last week, are that two of the big Magnificent Seven, Meta, which is Facebook to a lot of people, they had magnificent results, as did Microsoft. And we all know Microsoft, of course. But both of them absolutely smashed forecasts. Mm. As I speak this morning, I'm looking that Meta share price is up about 11%. Wow. As a result. They beat their revenue. They 20% revenue growth. This is the fourth biggest company in the world. Microsoft did 18% revenue growth. These are massive companies. You know, market caps of nearly $4 trillion.
Yeah.
Microsoft shares are up 8%, give or take. And they're spending, get this, this is enormous, and this helps other things in the AI sector. So Facebook are going to spend, well, Meta are going to spend $70 billion this year on AI-related expenditure. And Microsoft, $120 billion on AI-related things. So guess what? NVIDIA, the biggest supplier of AI chips, also went up a couple of percent as a result. And that helped push NASDAQ to this all-time high that we saw overnight.
Okay, right. Well, whose job is it to keep everything under control? Jerome Powell. And we heard from him in the last 48 hours, didn't we, CJ? What did the Fed have to say?
The Feds had their meeting. There was no surprise in the sense no one expected them to cut rates. But he was fairly hawkish, created a bit of concern in the market that maybe rates would not move down at the speed that they have done in the past. There were two people who dissented from the decision, obviously, and they both wanted lower rates. They obviously want his job, so they were positioning themselves for that.
And just explain what you mean by that?
Well, Jerome Powell's under a lot of pressure from Trump for not doing what Trump wants him to do. So Trump has talked about getting rid of him, but he's sensibly realised that next year that Jerome Powell's contract ends, and so he will then be able to appoint a new person. So anybody who wishes to be on the Donald Trump birthday list, the Donald Trump list of who could be the next chairman of the Federal Reserve would presumably want to get in his book. So they're voting to say, we think rates should come lower in order to get in the right spot.
And it's the first time since 1993 that you've had two people do that. This is
correct.
That's a big event. Now it's time to go on to the rest of the asset classes that we're going to introduce to the portfolio, and that is commodities.
Let's start with a really basic overview of commodities. All commodities are priced in US dollars, right? So you can use pounds to buy them, but you have to translate it in dollars and buy that. So as a rule of thumb, when the dollar falls, commodity prices tend to go up. So you have to, as an investor, have quite a good view about what's going to happen in the dollar. And when we come to talk about our portfolio next week, you'll obviously hear us talk about a view of the dollar because it's absolutely important because there's so many dollar assets in the world and commodities are the biggest chunk of them. In fact, commodities are actually, as a whole, bigger as a group than all of the equities in the world and bigger than all of the bonds in the world. Not many people think that. But of course, it's dominated. Commodities are dominated by oil and energy. It makes up about 83.4% of the overall commodity market.
Wow.
And then precious metals make about 6 or 7% of that. And then industrial metals, which is things like copper, nickel, aluminium, etc., 4 to 5%. And there are other stuff like soft commodities like wheat and sugar and coffee.
And
we're not really cocoa, I suppose, absolutely. But we're not really going to talk about those or rare earths because they're such a small proportion of the overall market. And the things that are really investable for us are things like, copper, gold, oil, etc. And those are the things we'll be focusing on more than anything else. Commodities also don't pay dividends or don't pay an interest charge. And we've talked about it. Obviously, bonds pay interest. Mm. Equities pay dividends. Commodities pay nothing. In fact, it costs you to hold commodities most of the time because you have to store them. They're big lumps of copper or iron ore or aluminium or gold or whatever it happens to be. And if it's gold or something valuable, then you have to insure it and there's an extra cost involved with that. So it's quite difficult to value commodities. And it really comes down to supply and demand. And we talked about that when we talked about equities and most of these assets. The more buyers you have and the less supply you have, that tends to push prices higher. And obviously, if there's too much supply and not enough demand, like during times of recession, prices tend to go down. So basically, it comes down to supply and demand for commodities, just like many other assets.
And those can be moved by politics, they can be moved by natural disasters, and you get a real swing from, as CJ alluded to, it takes years to get a new mine online and a hell of a lot of investment. So it's not like you can just click your fingers and turn a nuclear power station on. You know, a copper mine takes years and years of planning. So for instance, when we went through the financial crisis, suddenly in 13, 14, you know, you didn't have a lot of growth coming on. It's a complicated equation to find where that demand supply balances, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I remember 10 years ago sitting down with the chief executives of Rio Tinto and BHP and some of the biggest mining companies in the world and banging the table that they were not to spend money on new mines, etc., because they were the mugs. They just kept investing in new production, and it worked against them. So they kept oversupplying the markets and the demand wasn't strong enough. So the prices of many of the commodities went down. Now they learned that lesson. They overlearned it, in fact, and they pulled back massively from all this capital investment that they were doing. And so now if you look out, and we'll talk about copper in a minute, for example, you can't see any new big mines coming on for copper for the foreseeable future.
Right.
And as you say, even if they started today, found a new sort of copper deposit and took it to market, it would take, give or take, 19 years if it's outside the US. But in the US, because of the regulations are much stricter, et cetera, ironically, then it might take 25 years. So there is no new supply coming for a while. And, you know, copper is a major beneficiary of that, I would say. Just jumping into things like the industrial metals like copper, aluminium, iron ore, et cetera. To give you an idea, China today still buys more than 50%, more than half of all the commodities in the world. Half. That's amazing. If it's something like iron ore, they actually buy about 75%, three quarters of all the world's iron ore, and they turn it into steel, and they've obviously got big building construction projects, etc.
And a lot of Australians get paid a lot of money just to drive trucks and trains.
They certainly do. Although they ask for too much money, and then they introduce remote control vehicles. So they sort of shot themselves in the foot a bit there, I'm afraid, the Aussies. But, you know, things like copper, even copper, they still buy over half of the world's copper, right? China cannot be ignored. So the last time we had a massive super cycle was in the early 90s. And Rich, you'll remember because you were in the business at the time. But, you know, then you had massive moves up in all of these commodities because China was going on a huge growth project because they'd basically been let into the World Trade Organization, whereas before they'd been kept out of it. And so they went for growth, basically. And for 5 years, these commodities went up hugely in value. And it was very impressive. They still, like I say, buy more than half of all the world's commodities. So they cannot be ignored. And China have been having a tough time in the last few years. They've had deflation, they've got unemployment, their economies, they're struggling to get any growth going. It's been coming down and down and down. And so, it is an important factor. And now when you look at sort of the metals, if you were to rank the sort of what I'd call the industrial metals, but iron ore, for example, is the most economically sensitive. Then copper and aluminium are very high as well.
Okay, so what I'm hearing, if we hear anything on Chinese stimulus, that's one time that you might be interested in buying commodities.
Well, it's got to be the right sort of stimulus. So it's got to be about infrastructure building because things like copper go into electrical goods and into building houses. The amount of copper wiring in your house is enormous. You know, there's miles of it. And, you know, things like steel making go into things like that. So, you know, yes, it's very important. Construction, steel making. And as long as they're spending the money in the right way, then that is beneficial potentially for the commodity markets.
Now, you said that oil was 83%. Oil and energy, 83% of the total size of the market. I remember a time when it gives you the perfect example of supply-demand economics, where the supply was, you know, stable, but the demand collapsed during COVID because we all stopped even leaving our houses. Did the oil price go negative just after that?
It was a little bit before COVID, but it was around the global financial crisis. And basically what happened was the Americans particularly had pumped so much oil, they'd run out of space to store it. Now, you know, if you get oil out of the ground, you pipe it to a refinery. The refinery turns it into a different product, you know, sort of a different sort of oil, lighter or heavier, that goes into airplanes or your car or petrol or whatever. But you've got to store it somewhere. And all the storage in America was full. So actually, it's very difficult to stop pulling oil out the ground. Once you start pumping, you can't stop. It's very expensive to stop. So the poor Americans, let's feel sorry for them for a moment, the 10-gallon hats down in Texas.
Yeah, that's a yellow card for that one.
It's almost a red card.
The poor Americans.
That's a fair comment.
All-time highs.
Most of the Texans, et cetera, were drilling baby drill, which is obviously Trump's got them doing again. They were just producing all this oil and they had nowhere to store it. So they were literally paying people to take it away. And we hit a moment where West Texas Intermediate, which is the main American type of oil, in Europe we have Brent, that came out of the North Sea, the Brent field in the North Sea.
Right.
So Brent oil tends to be quite heavy and is UK and European based. And the Americans use a lighter oil, which is West Texas Intermediate. Well, West Texas Intermediate went to a negative price. I remember vividly, I was actually in Houston at the time, and I rang my mate at IG, Chris De La Vega, top man, and I said, Chris, I want to short these.
Oh, really?
What happens if it goes negative? Will IG make me a price that is negative, that allows me to make money when it goes negative? And he was right on the button. He came back and said, absolutely. And sure enough, I shorted it. And I was very lucky, because you've got to get lucky on some of these things.
Yeah.
And the timing, I happened to be in Houston. I saw how much pain they were going through. It went negative to about the tune of about $2 or something like that.
Wow.
So I was able to buy back my position that I was short and make a lot of money. I was very happy with that one.
It is time to move on to gold, because we have had a suggestion of what the penalty will be for a red card. And that is, CJ, tell us what will happen to Mark.
If Mark gets a red card, then I'm going to cut his hair off.
Are we talking a little or a lot?
No, it's all coming off.
It's all coming off. A number one all over. Well, you look quite similar at that stage. And if CJ gets the red card, what is going to happen?
I'm going to make him wear a wig, a Bee Gees wig. He's going to have to look like, you know,
for the whole episode.
Like he's staying alive for the whole time, yeah.
For the episode. I can live with that.
I think there will be a few people that have worked with you in the past that would very much enjoy that.
Right, so let's go to precious metals. So commodities, a big chunk of that, if you remember me saying about 7 or 8% of the total commodities market is precious metals. That's gold, silver, platinum, sometimes palladium. But basically the big chunk of that is gold, and that makes up about 3/4 of the precious metal market. And we all know gold, you know, most of us wear it. Anyway, let's go back to basics. Again, you know, gold is very difficult to value. But if you look at the end market for gold, about 45% of the end demand comes from jewelry, and about 25% comes from investors like us. If we were going to invest in gold, you can buy gold bars, you can buy sovereigns, you can buy Krugerrands, you can buy ETFs, etc. But so about 25%, a quarter of the market, the demand for gold comes from that investment side. Then you have these people called central banks, which you've talked about, the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, etc. They have reserves. They have to diversify their assets, a bit like we're going to do in our portfolio. And they buy gold as well. Traditionally, that's what they've always done. And we'll come on later and talk about Bitcoin. Will that begin to replace some of those holdings? But at the moment, about 17% of all the world's gold is held by central banks in their reserves. So there's not a lot of it to go around. And then other stuff goes into technology and drugs, where gold goes into drugs and tablets and things like that. It's got a pretty diverse usage.
Take us through what Gordon Brown decided to do with our gold reserves.
What a star he was. So yes, back in the, when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, he publicly told the world that we were going to sell down our gold reserves. And so, of course, the market makers and the market sort of got ahead of him, pushed the price down and down and down. And the minute he put his hands up and said, we're all done, we don't have any gold reserves left anymore, the price went shooting back up again.
And it's never been there since, $220 an ounce. And what is it today?
3,300, yeah. So that was the low, pretty much. What a star, eh? There we go. Let's move on quickly.
But central banks have been back in the market buying in the last couple of years, haven't they?
They have. People like, so the growth economies like India, like China, have been in buying gold for their reserves. And they've, you know, China started with no gold reserves, and India have been doing the same. India love gold, by the way. So actually the end demand, because jewelry demand is so big in India, that the Indians are the biggest buyers of gold as a country. They buy about 30% of all the gold out there. And China buy about 25% of it. I don't know if you know, but if you go around Beijing and Shanghai, they have vending machines with gold, little gold bars and gold coins in it that you can put your cash in and you can get gold out in vending machines.
As you can in Harrods here, I've heard from a friend.
Well, they wouldn't be in the East End because they would have been robbed by now, as they say in the book.
In fact, there have been some gold heists in London over the years.
Prince Mac, absolutely. It's been very good. So yeah, together, India and China account for over half of all the gold demand out there. And the rest of the world is only 45%. Gold can't be valued because, like all the other commodities, it doesn't pay a dividend, doesn't pay any interest. And to store gold, because it's valuable, you have to insure it and you have to sort of put it somewhere. And that charge, it can sometimes sort of be quite costly, particularly if interest rates are high. So if interest rates are high, you've got to worry that actually, you know, you're going to have to pay a lot to store in Hatton Garden or wherever you might want to hold your gold. So physical gold can be very expensive to store, and, you know, interest rates can hurt. So we have to be aware of that sort of thing. The supply side, a bit like copper and some of these other commodities, the mining companies have been very reluctant to invest in new production. So the supply side is quite constrained. And I'll give you a little thought here. When I first joined the city, there was this urban myth that you could, all the gold that had ever been mined throughout time, you could put it all together and put it in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Now.
And it's a myth.
It's a myth. It's not far off, though.
Okay.
So I have checked this out, and apparently you could fit it in 3.5 Olympic-sized swimming pools. Or, to give you some perspective, the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral would only be about half full if you put all of the gold that's ever been mined in the world in there. So if you've got some on your finger or in your grandma's sort of jewellery box, don't get rid of it without thinking about it. It's worth a lot.
I'd like to take a moment to make you aware of an awesome offer IG is currently running. Until the 15th of August, IG is giving away a free UK share bundle to all new customers worth up to £100 when you invest just £20. Sign up for a general investment account, a stocks and shares ISA, or a SIP, and make your £20 investment to get started. Your capital is at risk. The value of your shares, ETFs, and ETCs can fall as well as rise, which could mean getting back less than you put in. New customers only. Offer is valid until the 15th of August for ISA, GIA, and SIP accounts. Other fees may apply, and T&Cs apply. Fantastic. Now, what about those beautiful bitcoins? Take us on to the digital gold, the gold of the future, or is it, CJ?
It seems rather quaint that the oldest person around here is talking about the youngest gold asset. And so it falls on me to talk a bit about cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. First of all, let's all have a little bit of a health warning on these things. Cryptocurrencies are digital assets, but they're traded on unregulated exchanges. The assets are therefore not regulated by anybody. They're very high risk, and people need to understand that they are risky and they are volatile. Bitcoin itself was the first cryptocurrency, or digital token, as I think it's more accurately known. It was created by a chap called Satoshi Nakamoto in 2009. No one knows who he or she really is, although some suspect it might be Spicy.
If only. Do you think I'd be sitting here if it was me?
Yes. By choice.
Because you want to give so much back to us. That's what
obviously.
It is.
Widely believed that the creator or one of the creators is English. Because in the original paper, then words like colour were spelled the proper way.
As always, the conspiracy theorists will find something to back up their view on what's going on. I hadn't heard that one before. That's one to go into my scrapbook.
Perhaps Scottish.
They are created by Bitcoin miners who police the Bitcoin blockchain.
Chris, you just introduced a new term there, the blockchain. Take us through exactly what the blockchain is in relation to Bitcoin.
A blockchain can be thought of as a ledger, a digital ledger. And how can I bring that to life a bit better? A ledger is where records are kept. So think 100 years ago. You're going to your bank 100 years ago. There's someone who looks a bit like me, sitting behind a high desk.
Probably your brother, was it?
Or with a quill in my hand, marking money as it's coming in and marking money as it's going out. And I've got a ledger in front of me, and it's being done by hand. And that's how it all these things used to be done in the old days. In an electronic world, when you put it onto the computer system, this will be called a blockchain. The system is built to police itself. So it is, and it is decentralized. So there's a computer coding that's working in the background, making sure that things are only being marked onto the ledger when they have been agreed by all the participants, and they are the Bitcoin miners. The first person to agree that block, and everybody else then agrees it, wins a little prize of some Bitcoin. So the Bitcoin miners make sure the system works. The system is completely protected in terms of coding, so nobody can muck around with it. Mm-hmm. And that is your first example of a blockchain. And there is a limit to the amount of Bitcoin that ever can be created, because it's going to get more and more expensive. Over time, it gets more and more expensive through a process called halving. We don't need to go into the technicals of that in a moment, but it gets more and more expensive. There could only ever be 21 million of them, and there are 19.7 million at the moment. As with all cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin included, they're very easy to trade on these exchanges, but it's very difficult to get money from your bank to a platform, because given the reputation that cryptocurrencies have got, it's a very highly regulated process. And so when we think about how are we going to reflect positions in this world, if we want to have any within our portfolio, we're going to be thinking in terms of an ETF or buying off a platform such as IG. Why is this even relevant? I mean, there's this digital token that exists in the ether, let's say, somewhere. Why is that even relevant?
Mm-hmm. Right?
What we need to understand is that one of the goals of wealth creation is to protect the power of the pound in your pocket, or the dollar in your pocket, or whichever currency you are investing in. Unfortunately, the history of the global financial system is that when the going gets tough, politicians and central bankers tend to print money, and the currencies tend to fall. And just some examples of this, just to really make this clear. Did you know 50 years ago, the pound traded against the dollar at 2.4?
Wow.
50 years ago. And here now we are with the pound against the dollar at 1.3, and the Liz Truss debacle got us down almost to 1.
Yeah.
The pound buys far less of anything than it ever used to. So although we may look at our numbers and say, oh, I've got this much money, I've got that much money, in terms of buying power worldwide, it's poor. The dollar, if you had $1, it bought 20 times as much gold 50 years ago as it does today. $1 buys 20 times less gold.
So it does tick a lot of boxes. One of the first things you said is that supply and demand is very important in this whole complex that we're looking at today. Now, you've told me there's limited supply of Bitcoin. There's only ever going to be 21 million. There's limited supply of gold getting dug out of the ground. The central bankers continue, along with governments, to give endless supply of more dollars, more pounds, anytime there's a hint of a problem that they might not get voted back in. And therefore, that is what I do not like about fiat. And if I don't like fiat, I like
the alternatives. That's not fiat the car companies. That's not fiat the car companies.
I don't like those either. I can imagine Mark in a little chinky trend to them.
Alfa Romeo, maybe.
You used to have one called Fearless Fred. But that's for another day.
That's a long time. I mean, I think it's really important. And Bitcoin is going to be really interesting to see how it evolves, because gold for hundreds of years has been something of an inflation hedge. As Chris says, you know, gold has held its value against all these other currencies. So the inflation hedge means when inflation goes up, the price of gold goes up enough to compensate for you that. And, you know, even in the last sort of, in recent times, we saw when Russia invaded Ukraine and there was a huge amount of inflation, obviously interest rates had to go up. But, you know, the gold price is up 75% from where it was a month before the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Wow.
It has protected you against all that inflation you've had. And remember, we had 10%, 13% inflation around the world. It's also great at protecting you during crises. So, you know, it's notorious during wars, people take gold and they travel, and God forbid we never have to see that sort of thing again. But during the great financial crisis, gold rose 25% that year. When COVID happened, it rose 28% in the next 6 months. So gold has this habit of doing well when there's crisis and when there's inflation. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how Bitcoin does during this time. Now, my instinct is it is the new digital gold.
Now, this takes us perfectly on to when we're going to set up this portfolio. There's going to be the big launch next week. What kind of instruments are we going to consider whether they should be in there or not? So we thought it worthwhile to put up a graphic today of 25 to 30 of the kind of ETFs and instruments we will be considering. Now, we're using all the asset classes. That's why it was so important over week 2, 3, and 4 that we did these deep dives into equities, bonds, commodities, gold, and Bitcoin. They are just, you know, designed to reduce the volatility. Because, Chris, we're not going for racing against a benchmark, are we? We are looking at an absolute return. Just take everybody through what that means.
The plan is that we're going to construct a portfolio which will return 10% over the next 12 months. We'll be altering those allocations each week as we see fit, but that's the plan, to try to get to 10% or more, whether the markets go up or down. So we're going to have to really set ourselves a strict task. It's fine when equity markets are moving up and everything's fine. When they start moving in a negative direction, or they are moving in a, lots of assets are moving in different ways, we've got to catch the ones that are going up, right, and try to be out of the ones that are going down. So let's hope it's a really easy period. We don't have to work too hard. But knowing how these things always work, it'll be fun and nice and easy for a long lot of the time, and then suddenly something will blow up. And that's where we will be hoping to show people how live you can see the pain we're going through trying to make these decisions and decide what the right thing to do is, which should help our listeners with their own portfolios and what they're trying to do.
That's it. Spicy, you've got a wealth of experience in wealth management. Give us an idea how hard that is, because we're not just talking about making 10%. You know, somebody can make 10% in a couple of days, right, by having the right stock. But this is the design to teach people the skill set of making 10% every year, no matter, as CJ says, whether the markets are up or down.
It's incredibly difficult, incredibly difficult. And, people, just like you say, could go out and buy one stock and it goes up 10% in one day. And then if they were wise, they would sell it. And some hedge funds, I believe we were talking about earlier on, encouraged you to do that if you happen to have to make that money that quickly. But I think if you're with the wealth management industry, want you to stay invested. It's a natural thing. They want you to be invested because they get a fee out of what you are, you know, what you've got invested with them. And they get fees every time they trade, etc. Now, you know, there are rules about overtrading, and, you know, there are regulators try and stop that sort of thing. But we won't be overtrading unless we feel we need to have to. But we are very conscious about, as we've explored in our earlier episodes, the long-term returns you can get out of the different asset classes. And we know that equities are right up there, and they're the best inflation hedge, and they generate about 10% a year. And bonds give you about 4.6% a year, and cash gives you less than 3%. So with that in mind, imagine how the portfolio is going to be skewed if we are trying to make 10% a year over a long period of time. And that's what we're aiming to do.
Great. Now let's look at some of those assets. The wonderful graphic up on screen. If we're looking at equities, we wanted to have a breadth across Europe. So we've got choices there in UK, in the Eurozone, in Germany. Then further afield, of course, US large caps. We've got Japan. We've got China. We may want to be specific in emerging markets with some broad exposure there. We may want to be equal weighted. So take us through what the S&P 500 equal weighted is, Spice.
Well, you've heard us mention the Magnificent Seven numerous times now. Well, the Magnificent Seven, those seven companies alone account for 35% of the market capitalization of the entire S&P 500. Now, that means that there are lots of other, you know, there are another 493 companies underneath it that might be doing very well. Some of them might be doubling or trebling, but they're not big enough to make a difference in the top. But if you want exposure, a more even exposure, you buy what's called an equal weighted unit trust or ETF. And that means you have exactly, you know, sort of 1/500th in every single stock. And that way, if the Magnificent Seven don't do well and other stocks do, then you'll benefit that way.
And these are easy to find on the IG platform. You just use the search function.
Absolutely. And, you know, look at S&P 500 equal weighted and you'll get a list of things that you can invest in that will do that job.
And to get an idea of all the ETFs that are available, you can just search iShares and there's pages and pages of them along with other ETF providers. There's numerous, isn't there? There's VanEck, there's Granite Shares, there's
Wisdom Tree.
Yeah. I think we're going to be quite conscious. When I was a wealth manager, it's important to try and minimize the cost for your client. And we'll be doing exactly the same. So we're going to be looking for ETFs that do, or products that do the job, and they're cheap.
Now, take us on to, how do we get exposure to fixed income here? We've got a couple of gilts ETFs, in fact, three of those. Then we've got treasuries of different maturities.
I don't really want to see a sight in my mind again of the yield curve that we did last week with the two guys and holding hands out together. But different parts of the bond market are influenced by different things. So with the bond selections, we can focus on the very short-dated bonds, if you remember, the ones really affected by interest rates in the short term, or the very long-dated ones, those affected by supply and demand, inflation, all those other things. So we will be talking it through next week where we want that exposure. But we're just giving ourselves the tools to be very precise in where we want our exposure to be.
Excellent. And then moving on to this week's specials, the commodities. We've got the iShares Physical Gold ETC, Wisdom Tree Brent Crude Oil. We've got copper from both Wisdom Tree and a daily hedged version as well. And then we go on to our thematic blockchain VanEck crypto ETF. Now, take us through. That's not quite Bitcoin, is it?
Yeah, so you can't put Bitcoin as such into an ISA. The safest way to buy Bitcoin must be to buy an ETF of Bitcoin. Then they can see who owns it. It's open and transparent. We can't buy that. There's one in the States, the BlackRock ETF, biggest, I think, ETF probably now in the world. In the US, you can buy it. We cannot buy that here. So the only thing we can really buy here are surrogates of it. And there's one thing called the VanEck Crypto and Blockchain Innovator UCITS. It essentially invests in lots of companies all to do with Bitcoin. So Coinbase, MicroStrategy, you know, all these other things. That silly thing of yours that one day you'll talk about, do a smarter web company or whatever. I'm sure that one day will be there. All these things that are very linked to Bitcoin are in there, but not just Bitcoin, the power supply, the huge computer investment, all that sort of stuff is in there. It's a volatile instrument and it's pretty correlated to Bitcoin, but it's the best thing we can do.
Great. So, and then finally, we might want to have a little bit of cash, as most portfolio managers do. So we've got the Amundi Smart Overnight Return Money Market Fund in there. That just gives you a little snapshot of the choices that have to be made next week. It's going to be interesting. There's going to be a debate because I can already tell that we might not all see eye to eye. So tune in next week for the live portfolio manager.
The fighting portfolio construction meeting.
That's right. And it's exactly...
Bring it on.
Right. We've got a very quick question before we move on to the close of today. CJ, if I bought a 10-year bond, like you described the process of doing last week, so say I'm going to get a 7% coupon on that, right? So I've got it. I plan to hold it for the 10 years. Why do I care about the price movements from now until it matures?
In fairness, you answered the question yourself, which is if you're going to hold it till redemption, if you're going to hold it for the full period, you don't care. You don't mind where it trades in the intervening period because you're going to get your coupon every year and then you get your money back at the end. So you won't care. However, in the real world, we all buy things and then we suddenly think, oh, maybe my view's changed on where I think interest rates are going to go, or maybe I need cash to buy a new car or a house or whatever, or maybe there's some other expenditure that I need to make. And therefore, I need to think about, should I sell this bond? And that bond will then have moved according to how interest rate expectations have changed. And remember what we said before, if yields have gone up, guys, where a bond price has gone?
Lower.
So they've gone down, so you'll get a lower price then. And that's why it might be useful to you. If you're going to hold it to redemption, don't worry about it.
So that is us for the week, gents. Thank you very much for your wisdom drop yet again. If you've enjoyed what you've heard this week from the guys with that asset deep dive, then please like, subscribe, follow, tell your friends, tell your family, tune in on whatever and wherever you get your podcasts from. Again, every Friday in the afternoon, you can get us just before the European markets close. If there's any questions, where should everybody write to, gents?
Theartofinvesting@ig.com.
It's almost as if we practice it beforehand. Have a great week. We'll see you next week. Best of luck. Are we at all-time highs? Just as we launch the portfolio.